listen.
When Carol Gilligan published her 1982 groundbreaking book, In a Different Voice, enormous attention was directed to her conclusion, men and women silence parts of themselves to remain true to their gender. Many failed to notice her pioneering techniques of listening. The aha moment had occurred when a woman asked, "Do you want to know what I think or what I really think?" Carol wondered, how do people come to think in different ways from how they really think? What voices do people keep silent? How can I hear what is hidden? Which is such a great question. Carol Gilligan will joins us this morning to discuss her upcoming program, Deep Listening, how to hear the voices that people often keep silent. She is doing this program May 17th through the 19th at the Rowe Camp and Conference Center in Rowe, Massachusetts, and it is a delight, as always, to welcome our dear friend Carol Gilligan to the program. A wonderful moment to see you. Thank you very much.
Oh, Joe, thank you. I love being here.
Well, I love having you here. I so love what you do. Let us talk about deep listening and how you've come to. We'll ultimately get in what you're doing in Rowe, but how you came to this idea, and ultimately how we benefit from it.
You know, it wasn't so much an idea I came to. It's just the quote you. I started to hear something, or it actually started when I was teaching at Harvard, and there were men in my class who had been very voluble, you know, outspoken, clear. Right. This was a long time ago. They were talking about the Vietnam War. Was it just or was it unjust? And suddenly we started talking about the draft, and they became completely silent because that was a dilemma they were really facing. And I thought, these very, very talkative students, why were they suddenly silent? And what was it that they weren't saying? I became interested in what wasn't being said. And so what I found out is that, in fact, why they were silent is that they didn't want to say that they're thinking about whether or not to resist the draft was influenced by their feelings about people they cared about and how it would affect other people and how they would feel, as well as about their thoughts about the war and whether it was just or unjust and so forth. And if they said it aloud, they would sound like women who were thought to be concerned with relationships and feelings, and they would be seen as less developed morally. So, I mean, I thought it was actually an act of integrity rather than saying what wasn't what they thought. They said nothing. And I became really interested in that.
Is it how much of it is not wanting to be declarative and saying, this is how I feel, and not wanting to share the thought process and to say, this is what I'm thinking about and the issues that I'm mulling over? I'm not ready to share that declarative to you.
Well, you know, that's a really, I find that fascinating. When any of us are ready to say out loud or even know what's going on in our head and thinking. And of course, I confront that because I interview people. Well, you do too.
Sure.
But I'm interested if I'm going to, you know, write about the human world and represent it, I want to get the complexity of it. And
sure.
I want to have, so for example, I was interviewing women, and one of the things that really struck me was the word selfish, which would occur repeatedly. And I realized that women were labeling whatever they wanted to do selfish, where it was good to do what other people wanted them to do. And I remember asking women, if it's good to be responsive to people and concerned, you know, about their needs, you're a person, why is it selfish to respond to yourself? And this, again, was when I started my work. And woman after woman said to me, good question. So it's not only sort of the internal, am I ready to say out loud, do I even know what I, you know, sort of think, but what do I think I can't say without sounding, for example, selfish? Or, you know, for what do men think they can't say without compromising their manhood or their masculinity? And
the program, Deep Listening, How to Hear the Voices That People Often Keep Silent, by its phrasing and its nature, puts it on us in the sense of that we are responsible to listen closely, to hear what is being said.
You know, I think that's true. I mean, I think that sometimes we think listening is just passive. But I tell my students, I think listening to someone is one of the greatest gifts you can give them. You know, because so often, I mean, how many times do we really feel that someone sits down, takes the trouble, sits and listens, is really interested? And I think that, you know, when somebody is really listening and responds so that you feel that they're really, they are hearing you and they're interested, often you find yourself able to say more. I mean, whereas, I don't know about your experience, but it's mine. If I'm speaking and I feel I'm not being listened to or heard, I can hear my voice. It sort of goes back into myself. So I think voice depends on listening. Speaking depends on listening.
Is there ever a danger that through deep listening and listening for and trying to listen for something, to hear that hidden voice, that we are bringing with us an idea of what either we want to hear or what we are expecting to hear or an intuition that we have, to fill in those blanks instead of it being a pure discussion?
You know, have you ever heard of Jonathan Shea, the psychiatrist who
Yes.
works with combat veterans?
Yes.
And he has this wonderful sentence in the beginning of his book, Achilles in Vietnam, which, you know, I always read with my students. And he says, before analyzing, before classifying, before thinking, before, you know, thinking about what to do, just listen.
Right.
And the thing for me, and what has really been the engine of my research, is when what I hear surprises me. So, you know, I've heard, a five-year-old says to his mother, Mama, why do you smile when you're sad? And it's like he's picking up what's underneath, what's behind that. And I'm really struck by how much, in effect, if we listen and how much we in fact do know about other people, it's very different from coming with preconceived notions and slotting people into bins. And what always gets me started to write is when I hear something I didn't expect, and it completely changes the way I think.
And it's, and I use the word pure, but to have that purity where you're not coming with anything, you just want to hear what the person has to say, and that comes through looking at them in the eye, and to be engaged in the conversation, and have that moment. But that takes two, right?
That takes two. Yeah. But, you know, if somebody, I mean, things that surprised me, I remember when I was doing the work with girls, and this 16-year-old, and she's, you know, she's one of these radiant girls and everything else. She's doing terrifically. And she says, if I were to say what I was feeling and thinking, no one would want to be with me. My voice it would be too loud. And then you think, I mean, it's that kind of statement that catches my ear.
How could that voice be too loud?
Yeah, and why does she think? And if she's, so then I say to her, I don't just sort of sit there. I don't have a category for this. And I say, she says, but you have to have relationships. I think that's true. But I say to her, if you're not saying what you're feeling and thinking, then where are you in these relationships? And I realize she sees it. You know, she's facing a kind of paradoxical situation. So then I think I could learn from her about how she is navigating this. So that's what I mean by listening. And not just sort of staying on the surface of a conversation, but, you know, when it peaks, my curiosity, or when you hear something that you think, really? And sometimes I would even say that when I was interviewing. I mean, I remember a girl said to me, I don't like myself enough to look out for myself. And I said to her, do you really feel that way?
Do you know what that means?
Yeah. And then you know what she said? She said, actually, this is how I look out for myself.
Mm.
So that's what I don't mean deep listening in the sense of fishing for something that you could slot into. I mean being drawn in by, you know, where the surface of the conversation kind of opens, you know, so that you're not hearing just sort of the story people just tell without even thinking, but what's just being interested in how they make sense of themselves, their lives, their world. And
so given the example that you just gave, what do you, meaning the listener,
yeah,
and the person who is being listened to, get out of that? What are the possibilities?
Well, I'm learning from her how she navigates her world. I mean, she says, I don't like myself enough to look out for myself. I say, do you really feel that way? She says, actually, this is how I look out for myself. I never say what I'm actually feeling and thinking in that way. Whatever anybody says about me, I don't care because they don't know who I am. And then she looks at me and she says, brilliant, isn't it? And I say to her, yes, because it is, in its own terms, a brilliant strategy. But she had said to me that what she wanted was honesty in relationships. So I say to her, but it's at the expense of what you said you wanted, which is honesty in relationship.
Mm.
Okay, now I've learned something. I've learned that this sense of so-called low self-esteem in girls, that you really, that's a label. You want to listen, what's behind that?
Right.
She's learned that there's actually somebody, me in this case, who's interested enough in her to engage with her and not just kind of slot what she says, but to ask her some questions so that she and I end up at a very different place than where we started.
And how can she take that to the next step to empower her to be able to almost have that conversation with herself?
You know, well, there's a lot of talk about respect for persons, and that certainly is a really good idea. And I think listening to someone is a deep manifestation of respect. And I think, you know, life is complicated and many things happen, but if you have the experience that there was somebody who was really interested in how you thought and felt, and listened to you and respected you, I mean, I think you take something from that forward, which is a sense of self-respect.
So, for people listening, and I, without veering off here, but I, there is a difference between Carol Gilligan listening and my neighbor. Do you think? Do you see that?
Well, I think if your neighbor came to the Road Center this weekend, the distance would close.
Well, absolutely. Meaning, you have been trained. You are ready to.
Oh, I've had lots of experience by now. Sure.
Absolutely, and that's what I'm asking. So how you, and obviously this is an attempt to train others.
Well, it's my discovery because I've been teaching this for a long time now. I started when I was at Harvard. I teach at NYU. I went to the University of Cambridge last year and taught a master class for history PhD students. They were working, one of them, with trial transcripts from early modern Germany, trials of male witches, if you can believe it. And the question was there a sense of self in early modern Germany? Now, you could debate that in some abstract intellectual way. So she has the transcript, and in the middle of this transcript, here's this man trying to defend himself against this charge, and suddenly this voice comes out, I, Conrad Streich, I, you know, about his experience of being called a witch and put on trial, and you listen to it, and it was extraordinary. I, through years of doing this now, think, because I tell my students at NYU, in 13 weeks you'll learn this method, and I'm trying to see how far I can go in a weekend.
Is this whole thing about that we silence parts of our of ourselves to remain true to our gender. Does that has that changed? I mean, have we?
I hope so. I really hope so. I mean, what I mean is, there are things, I think you could speak to this more than me, that men feel that if they said what they certain things, that they would seem like less of a man. Or women feel if they said certain things, they perceived as not a good woman.
Mm.
And I do think that this is really changing. And I think that's great, because what we're doing is silencing parts of our humanity in order to, you know, conform to these gender notions that say that, you know, to be a man, you can't have certain feelings, or to be a woman, you know, you have to watch your voice is not too loud, or it's not too much, or whatever.
It seems to me that there are so many variables, though, aren't there? I mean, we have male, female, we have our gender roles, and then, but it's even, it's genetic, and it's geographical, and it's would someone who is in a university setting at Harvard or NYU respond differently than in the South or in the West, a red state versus a blue state?
Well, you know, I mean, sure. I mean, if I was sitting in a cold place, I would respond differently than if I were sitting in a, you know, a hot place. Of course you're right. Of course you're right. On the other hand, you know, what's been striking to me, you know, because I started my research when I did In a Different Voice. I was interviewing women who were at street front clinics in South Boston and so forth. It was how thoughtful people are, and often these assumptions we make about who is and who isn't are completely off. And
oh, absolutely.
So I'm always interested in, and I think there are a lot of people, and I think this was one of the effects of my book, In a Different Voice, and also the girls' work, who feel that they're not heard and they're not taken seriously. And if they said what they were really think, they'd be called crazy, or they'd be told they were wrong. And so they don't. And so, you know, one of the things that I've done in my writing is to kind of amplify those voices and give resonance and show how a voice that could be dismissed as stupid really isn't stupid if you listen to it.
Meaning, and what I was asking, and if you grow up in a very conservative household, in a very religious setting, and you find at the core you are told this is the role you are supposed to play, but this is very much not who you are, of being able to escape that. And where there are more comforting environments than others.
You know, I'm fascinated when people grow up in that kind of environment and they know this is not me, and how they know that.
Oh, sure.
I mean, and that happens, and it's certainly, you know, all the people who grew up gay and so forth at a time when they were not supposed to be, and yet within themselves, they knew, I don't fit into this.
And can I just interject just with a side question, because I was thinking about this, of and we were talking about this earlier in the program, that because that movement has taken off so, and we have made it certainly not widely acceptable, but much better and much more tolerant
right.
than it was to come out to friends and to family and to be true to who you are, then how do we take it to the next step that all of us can feel that way and be true to whoever we are and how we feel?
Yeah, well, my good friend and my colleague at NYU, Kenji Yoshino, wrote a book called Covering. You know, as a gay man, he wrote that book. But he said covering is the civil rights issue of our time, which is, in fact, we all cover. And, what are the conditions in which we can feel freer to reveal who we are? And I think, you know, a lot of the times we think in terms of sort of categories, red state, blue state, you know, the 1%, the 99%, and so forth. And all these categories are important and they're real, but there's also a psyche and there's also a capacity for resistance. And, you know, my work has always been about voice and resistance and how do you listen, you know, for a voice that might be held in silence, that might be under political or religious or some other form of oppression. And, you know, what if you start with the assumption that somewhere in there, there's a voice and there's a capacity for resistance.
And that capacity, I mean, it doesn't mean that you have to be the activist. You don't have to be yelling the loudest on the street corner, but that you realize it. Because it ultimately, isn't what we're ultimately talking about in all of this is a level of joy and happiness?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And I mean, I think that's, you know, I've been surprised about it. There's a certain kind of happiness or joy in feeling that someone's interested, that somebody is listening, that you can say what you really feel and think. And in fact, someone will stay with you. They don't just walk away. You can talk with them, you know.
And this comes down, I mean, there's civility and there's acceptance.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's a huge mistake to think that if you talk about people saying what they really feel and think, you're talking about people just being rude and unthinking. I mean, that's absolutely not so. But it was really striking to me, and it came to the surface really when I did this long project on research with girls after In a Different Voice. And I watched as girls, you know, who had been so frank and fearless in the best sense. I mean, you know, just saying what they saw and knowing what they knew, you know, beginning to say, I don't know, as a cover for what they in fact knew, to feel that they couldn't say what they saw or know what they knew and also be in relationship with other people. And it was interesting because the girls were aware of this and they described what they were doing. And that's that was when I really started to think about how do you listen for what's under the conversation? I mean, how do you listen for what somebody knows? And they need some cue from you that if they tell you what they know, you're not going to abandon them or judge them. You listen to it. Talk with them.
So you're doing this program, Deep Listening, at the Roe Campbell Conference Center. And you were going to be talking about techniques. Is it something, are some of us hardwired better to do this than others? Because we have an empathy that we want to listen, that we want to. I mean, I find this in interviewers, I find this in journalists, that there are people that I work with that come in and in teaching as well, that will do it because they are open-minded and they want to listen and they have that curiosity. And then there are others who really don't care.
You know, what I say to my students is, notice what happens when you replace judgment with curiosity.
Mm.
And I think often there's
just this. But can you teach that?
Well, I say, you know, put up a sign over you. Like, every time you hear yourself judging, this is this, this is this. Again, Shea has this wonderful phrase about how, you know, too often, particularly professionals, you know, what we do is we take people's words and sort them into mental bins, things we have in our heads. And he says we're like museum goers who go through the museum and say, that's Cubist, that's El Greco, and never see anything that's in front of them. So what I focus on is, how do you release curiosity? Because if you're curious, I mean, that's the openness that you're talking about. I mean, whether it's with journalism or psychological research. So I have my students at the beginning.
But that would indicate that we're all capable of it.
Oh, I think, you mean, just hang around children, Joe. I mean, that's where we start. You know, why is the moon in the sky? why do we go to bed at night? I think, you know.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, we start with a lot of curiosity and a lot of wonder and a lot of interest. And I think the sense is often that gets kind of corralled and narrowed. There are certain questions you can ask, and there are certain things you can ask, and there are certain things you can see, other things you can't see, and you know you can listen to certain things you're not supposed to hear, you know, that people are saying things that are counter what the way they present themselves, and so you start to shut down. So what is this is saying, wait a minute, within ourselves, you know, there's that curious child, so let's access that, and that's the person who listens.
And curious and an open-mindedness and ultimately free of judgment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the little five-year-old who says to his mother, Mommy, you have a happy voice, but I also hear a little worried voice. Now, the issue is going to hinge on, can she allow him to know that, yes, she has a happy voice, but she also has a little worried voice? Or do we say to children, no, you know, you can't know that? Or another, I love these examples from little boys. I'm a mother of boys. Little boy says to his mother, Mommy, why are you sad? And she says in one of these high voices, I'm not sad. You know how that kind of.
Yeah.
And he says to her, Mommy, I know you. I was inside you. And okay. Can we allow people to know us that way?
And unfortunately, we have to go and we're out of time. But what fascinates me about this is, because you're so great, is that you say, okay, of what she says obviously affects her and her voice, but also what she is saying is affecting him,
right,
and his curiosity in the future.
Yeah,
because if she is honest, then he can remain honest.
That's, and if she says that, if you love me, you won't know me.
Yeah.
That's a very difficult position, wow, for him to be in.
Well, you could talk about this for an entire weekend, and Carol will be doing that. It is May 17th through the 19th at the Roe Camp and Conference Center in Roe, Massachusetts. Find out more information at roecenter.org, roecenter.org. It's Deep Listening, How to Hear the Voices That People Often Keep Silent. May 17th through the 19th at Roe Camp and Conference Center in Roe, Massachusetts. Carol, I wish you a very happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
Thank you so much for all your great work and for sharing with us on this Friday. I appreciate it.
Well, I love coming and talking with you.
Thank you
so much for inviting me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.